Our guests this hour, full of you astronomers or people who for years and years have gazed at the sky. You'll love this program, and there are many sophisticated astronomers among our listening audience. The author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming is this hour's guest. Our guest is Mike Brown. He is professor of planetary astronomy at the California Institute of Technology, where he has been on the faculty since 96. He specializes in the discovery and the study of bodies at the edge of the solar system, and he's best known for his discovery of Eris, the largest object found in the solar system in 150 years, and the object which led to the debate and an eventual demotion of Pluto from a real planet to a dwarf planet. There have been a lot of articles written about Brown and his work in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Discover. He has been named as one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People, as well as Los Angeles Magazine's Most Powerful Angelinos. He's authored over 100 scientific papers, and he's our guest this hour. It's not only an informative book, it's highly entertaining as well, as you can tell from the title. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Mike. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you here. You start the book with August 25th, 2006, the last day of the International Astronomy Union meeting in Prague. Why do you start? What happened with that meeting in 2006?
Well, that's the day. That's the meeting at which Pluto was eventually demoted, and that's the day that the demotion happened. So it is a bit of a funny place to start the book with the ending of Pluto getting demoted, but it really sets the stage for the rest of the book that tells the story leading up to there.
And you had to get up at 4:30 in the morning because the press was going to be arriving.
Yeah, the meeting was in Prague, and I wasn't actually at the meeting, but I was hosting a press event in Pasadena because everybody wanted to watch and see what the astronomers were going to vote. I didn't even know what the astronomers were going to vote. Even the astronomers who were going into the room didn't quite know what they were going to be voting on. And so I hosted this meeting for the event in Prague, which meant it started at about 4 in the morning here, and you would think that at 4 in the morning there would be nobody around, and the press room was packed with people wanting to see what's going to happen to Pluto.
You were surprised by that, too, weren't you?
I was.
Yeah, I mean, you got a little bit dressed up for the day, but
I did. It's, you know, I don't usually dress up so nicely at 4 in the morning, but that day it was a little better than usual.
Are you a member of the Astronomical Union?
The International Astronomical Union, I'm actually not, strangely enough. It's just, you know, it's one of those things that I've never quite gotten around to joining, and so I knew this meeting was going on, and that the meeting was going to vote not just on Pluto, but also on the eventual status of the things that I had discovered. And I thought, oh, gee, I should, you know, join and go to the meeting. And I thought, you know, it's probably better to recuse myself. If they had voted to keep Pluto as a planet, then they would have also voted to have many of the things that I had discovered would be planets, and I would instantly be the most prolific planet discoverer in human history, which is kind of a funny thing. So I thought, you know, best not to be at that meeting and not take part in that vote. I'll just wait and see what happens.
Tell me a little bit, I know it's in the book, about the history of naming planets and discovering planets. When did it start? Who named them? The whole process of naming planets is also fascinating. Did people start naming these and discovering them long, long ago?
Well, the original planets, I like to point out, the seven original planets, almost nobody can ever guess what the seven original planets were, because they always try to include the Earth, which was, of course, not a planet, and they forget to include the Sun and the Moon, but the Sun and the Moon were originally just thought to be planets like the other planets, too. And so those were known for, obviously, a long time, and named. Every culture has different names for those. But then when the new planets started getting discovered, the first new planet that was discovered that hadn't been known since antiquity was Uranus, and then Neptune. And like things that are discovered today, the naming was a bit controversial. People seem to always want to name things for their themselves or their king or something. And so it took a while for the names for Uranus and Neptune to settle in. And these days, Pluto actually came pretty quickly. It was only about a month before the name of Pluto got identified. And then these days, we're not discovering new planets, but we're discovering all these objects in the outer solar system, each of which gets a name. And I spend way too much time on these names because it's actually really sort of fun. I like to make sure the names have some sort of
resonance, meaning. Sure.
With the actual object itself. And so I've gotten to do a little bit of amateur study of different world mythologies and try to find appropriate names for everything out there.
Yeah. Now, Mike, have you discovered a new planet?
I discovered the thing that is more massive than Pluto, that for an entire year was referred to as the 10th planet. But it, at the same time that Pluto got demoted to not being a planet anymore, it also got demoted to not being a planet anymore. So no. The easy answer is no, I haven't discovered that. The last new planet discovered was Neptune in 1845, and I suspect that will be the last new planet ever discovered in our solar system.
Really?
Yeah.
So what was the deal? Now, is your planet Eris?
Eris. My non-planet.
Your non-planet. Well okay. Maybe we can be convinced that it should be a planet by the end of this hour. What was the deal with that? Why didn't they take your planet as a new planet?
Well, it's what it really did, for a while, astronomers had been starting to question whether Pluto should have been a planet or not. So when Pluto was discovered in 1930, it was thought to be huge. It was thought to be maybe the mass of the Earth and affecting the outer solar system greatly. And over time, as more and more studies of Pluto came along, astronomers realized that it was smaller and smaller and smaller than they thought, and it turns out to be something like 1/500th of the mass of the Earth. So the astronomers in 1930 were only wrong by a factor of 500. That's not so bad for astronomers. But it really changes how you look at it when you realize it's such a tiny little object out there. And then in 1992, starting in 1992 and then increasingly since then, astronomers started finding more and more and more things like Pluto outside of Neptune. Once you realize that Pluto is really tiny and that there are many other things like it, you realize that Pluto and all of the other objects out there are more like the asteroid belt, that band of debris between Mars and Jupiter, than like a separate planet and then another band of debris. So it was clear for a while that Pluto really had been a mistake back in 1930. It didn't really belong. And yet astronomers were reluctant to officially demote it just because they don't like irritating the rest of the world, and everybody knew it would irritate the rest of the world. And what finally happened is that when I discovered this one that was what was more massive than Pluto, once you find something more massive than Pluto, you can't hide your head in the sand anymore. You have to decide what you're going to do. You have to decide if this new thing that was discovered is a planet, or you have to decide if it's not a planet, and then Pluto's not a planet. So however Pluto goes, so goes this new one.
Huh.
And I think astronomers at that point said, look, you know, we really did make a mistake back in 1930. We're either going to compound that mistake by adding a 10th planet that really shouldn't be a 10th planet, or we're going to suck it up and do the right thing and admit that really there should have only been 8 to begin with, and Pluto is part of this vast new belt of debris called the Kuiper Belt.
So were you heartbroken by this, or was it okay?
It was, you know, it was an interesting reaction. My very first reaction when the vote came down was elation, and I was elated because I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that astronomers had the guts to actually describe the solar system the right way, even against what would clearly be public outcry. So, as someone who is a researcher but also an educator, I think that explaining to people that there are only 8 planets in the solar system forces them to view the solar system in the correct way. Trying to tell people that there are 9 or 10 planets is this weird artificial description that doesn't teach you very much about the real solar system. It doesn't teach you anything about the real solar system because it just is not very true. So my first reaction was elation. My second reaction was a little bit of sadness. This object that I had been studying for a year, that I had found a year and a half earlier, that had been called the 10th planet. That was, I was in love with this little body in the outer solar system, and still am. And it was a little sad, even though it was the right thing. It was a little sad.
Yeah.
So I understand the people who are sad about Pluto. They have this emotional attachment to it.
Well, sure.
It's the right thing, but it's still kind of sad.
We can't help who or what we fall in love with, right?
I you're absolutely
That's
right.
That's what I was thinking. But now we're all messed up with this. My very educated mother just showed us 9 planets, which is how we remember them. So do we have a new saying?
You know, so my very favorite one... of the new sayings came that the very day that the demotion happened. I was on another radio show, and somebody had called in. The host had asked people to come up with new mnemonics for the planets, and somebody called in that very day, and I thought, this is the most clever person in the world. And it was, mean, very educated men just shortened up nature.
I like it. Let's go way back before you started. You found this in your year of looking at the sky and your many years of looking at the sky, because I like to hear about people's childhoods. The New Yorker article about you said that for as long as Brown can remember, he has looked at the night sky whenever he steps outdoors. What was fascinating to you about the night sky? Did you look at it when you were a little kid?
I always did when I was a kid, and I still do it now. I didn't ever actually realize that's what I do. My wife actually pointed it out to me that I literally walk out the door and look up before then doing whatever it is I walked out the door to do. And it's, for me, to these days, it's just taking my bearings. It's just checking that everything is in the right place. It's checking the weather in case I'm observing somewhere. But it really is, it's just making sure that I am where I'm supposed to be in the universe, and the rest of it is there too. And I don't know when I first started doing that, but I know that as a kid, I would always just stare up at the skies. I grew up in northern Alabama, which is darker than it is around here in Los Angeles, where I live now. So I would spend a lot of time just sitting out on the back porch and staring. And I didn't know very much about the sky at those ages. You would recognize it. It would just become part of your neighborhood. And I remember as a kid being fascinated by the fact that it didn't matter where I traveled around, maybe not very far, you know, traveling around different parts of northern Alabama, it would look different. If I looked out the window, I would see, you know, different trees and different mountains. But if I looked up, it was still the same universe. And I always found that a very comforting feeling and very, I just felt that this was my home.
Yeah. Your father was working on the Apollo mission?
He was working on the on some of the computers that landed the lunar module. He worked on the lunar rover that drove around there. So it was a very exciting time to grow up there in Huntsville in northern Alabama. Most of the fathers, and it was at that point exclusively fathers, it seemed like most of the fathers were working hard to get the Apollo mission happening, and the rockets were being built right there, the rocket engines. You could hear the testing of the rocket engines. If you were just, you know, you'd be sitting outside playing, and all of a sudden the ground starts to rumble, and you see a little plume of smoke rising, and you knew that was the Saturn V being tested that morning.
Oh, goodness. And you asked in seventh grade for a subscription to a magazine, which we deal with the writers frequently because it's published here in Wisconsin, Astronomy Magazine. I had to throw that in.
It's true. You know, people sometimes call me up or send me email and ask me, you know, what can I get for my kid? Can I get them this telescope or this, that? For me, that was really my introduction to the science of doing astronomy. I still had, you know, stared at the sky a lot, but I didn't really understand what it was that I was seeing. And it's at the time, and I think it still is, incredibly accessible for, you know, if you have there, I find parents all the time who have this middle school or high school kid who's just obsessed with astronomy, and they don't know where it came from, and they don't know what to do with the kid. And I say, just start there. Go get them, you know, this magazine, and see what happens.
Hmm. Let's go to Tony, who's calling you on the road. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good morning. Dr. Brown, the book was very, very enjoyable. I'm not a science guy. I'm not an astronomer, but kind of a space geek. And I always like science that's written understandably and the rare occurrence with humor, because I've been recommending the book to people. And my wife adds, with political intrigue and romance as well.
Right.
I was wondering if you've taken any grief for the amount of humor in the book, as well as for killing Pluto, which good for you for doing, given the amount that you had to gain from discovering the 10th planet. And I'll hang up soon.
Thank you, Tony. All right. Thanks, Tony.
Well, first, Tony, thanks for those nice words about the book. I'm really glad you enjoyed it. I've taken a lot of grief for killing Pluto. I have people who it just rubs them the wrong way, particularly if you say you killed Pluto, which,
of course,
you know, I sort of say tongue-in-cheek, but they still just, you know, it's the people who have these really strong emotional attachments don't like to make jokes about killing Pluto. So certainly there are a small number of people there in the astronomical community who are still sort of upset about it, but there's still, I think, a pretty wide public misunderstanding of what happened, and that's one of the reasons for having written the book, to try to explain to people why it happened. In the book, no one seems to have bristled too much at the humor, which is good, because it's the story it's an inherently a funny story in many different ways. It's hard not to tell the story with the human factor and the humor that it all came along with. So I've been heartened that people seem to have resonated well to that part.
Well, he mentioned romance, and I'm a sucker for hearing romantic stories, but it is quite a story how you met your wife, because you went on these exotic trips where you were the speaker and she was doing the tours. You went all over the place, and then all of a sudden you noticed her.
It was, you know, the very first time that I ever saw her was on one of these trips, and it was at the telescope that I had used for all these studies to find these objects, and her group was coming to get a lecture from me at the telescope, and she just walked in the door, and I was supposed to be giving everybody a tour of the telescope, and I think I ended up giving her mostly a tour of the telescope and ignoring the rest of the group. And then all the time thinking, oh, stop doing that. You got to stop doing that. You're going to make an idiot of yourself. Oh, don't do that. But it eventually worked out okay.
Yeah, I would say so. And she is somebody she's vitally interested in what it is you're doing. I found it really heartwarming that she knew all about your work, and you, she's the person you call.
Yeah, she was. This is the second person in the world to know that I had just discovered something larger than Pluto was my wife. I found it one morning in January 2005. It took me about 5 minutes to verify that I hadn't done something wrong. And as soon as it was cemented in my mind, this was real. I really had found this. It's out there. There's no getting around it. I immediately just picked up the phone and called her told her. In fact, what I told her is I had just found a planet.
Oh, what did she say? Do you remember?
You know, she was at the time 3 months pregnant with our child, and I think that at that moment she was a little bit less interested in the things going on in my profession. So I think she probably said something like, oh, "That's nice, honey. You know, Don't forget to bring the milk home with you tonight." And then, of course, I forgot to bring the milk home.
Oh, no. Our guest is the author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Mike Brown is the Richard and Barbara Rosenberg Professor of Planetary Astronomy at the California Institute of Technology, and he discovered a planet. We're going to welcome more phone calls. Please give us a ring or send an email if you can't do the telephone. Again, it's 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us at 800-486-8655. Can you tell us, please, Mike, about the process of discovering a new planet, the telescope that you use, how much of the sky you need to look at, how you verify this?
It's I'll answer the part about how much of the sky first, because it's an interesting question, which is if your goal was to find a new planet, which was my goal starting in about 1999, I was pretty convinced that there was a new planet out there. And by new planet at the time, I meant something bigger than Pluto, because, you know, I knew that Pluto was a planet and astronomers would never demote Pluto. So clearly, if you find something bigger, it's a planet. But I didn't know where it was, because there's no evidence that there's such a planet out there. There's no way to tell ahead of time where it is. So the only way to find it is to look at the whole sky. And the way you have to look at the whole sky is you can't just take a picture of the sky and look for a planet, because these things are so far away, they just look like little dots of light like any distant star. You have to take a picture of the sky, and then you have to come back a couple of hours later and take a picture of the same spot in the sky. And anything that's in our solar system that's orbiting around the sun will have moved. And the amount that it moves tells you how far away it is, which means you can tell it if it's one of these very large, distant things versus something closer. So what I had to do is look at the whole sky and pick multiple pictures of each spot in the sky looking for things that moved.
Oh.
It was a difficult process, because at the time, starting in 1999, the cameras that we had were really tiny. We had these digital cameras, you know, just like if you remember back to the Stone Ages of digital cameras in the early 2000s or late 1990s, they were these, I don't know, 400 by 600 pixel things instead of the tens and thirteens of megapixels we have now. So these digital cameras were tiny. They covered tiny fractions of the sky. And we finally made it all work by getting about 100 of these cameras, slapping them all together on the back of the telescope, and being able to take a big, wide swath of the sky at once. Even so, it took us nearly 10 years to cover the whole sky looking for these things that moved. And so night after night after night, we would look at a little patch. In the morning, the data would come down to the computer in my office here in Pasadena, and the computer would crank through looking for all the things that were stationary, throw them all out, and then show me all the moving ones. And I would look at many, many, many possible things by eye, most of them just being glitches in the camera that the computer hadn't found. But every once in a while, I would be staring at my screen, and up would come a pretty little dot that would move. I would take three pictures, so you'd see it go boom, 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 moving across the sky. And it was just this instant spark. You just knew it when you saw it. And it was always, even when they weren't big like the one that was bigger than Pluto, even these small ones that we found, every time you find one, you know, it's a 100 or 200 mile across chunk of rock and ice in the outer solar system that no one had ever seen before. And it's just a little charge that you get every time.
Oh, what a story. Let's go to Alan. I'm so glad Alan called. He's director of the Planetarium in Menasha and is a friend of ours. We've spent time with Alan and talked to him before, and he was on our show when we did the broadcast from Appleton some time ago, and he's calling in. Hi, Alan. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Kathleen. What a great show.
Good morning. I thought you might think so.
I love the science behind Pluto. And as the book says, I mean, we get this anger, even in my planetarium, of people who are really upset about Pluto. And I love that science changed the rules because it made sense to change the rules, and we just have to follow along. And Pluto, when we discovered it in 1930, didn't we think it was about the size of the Earth? And
yeah.
Now we just know so much more.
And tell me, why are people angry as they come to your planetarium and lash out against this?
I think it's just a change, and they're not comfortable with that change. In fact, before the final rule came down on Pluto, there was a different, more obscure rule about whether it had a Barry's center and all this other stuff. And for me, it was more complicated, but the science was just really cool. It allowed us to have a discussion with the people about what science is about and how we have to change our understanding with our knowledge.
And it gives you the opportunity to explain the solar system. I mean, imagine if just Pluto had stayed a planet and that was the end of the story. Then nobody would care. And now people deeply care. You know, I know this because I if I sit on an airplane and I tell people I'm an astronomer, I don't even say I'm Mike Brown and I killed Pluto. I just say I'm an astronomer. The first question they always ask is, what's that deal about Pluto? Why are you guys
mean? Oh, no, they don't know who they're talking to.
You have to tell them about the solar system, which is just a fantastic thing to get to do.
Even in one of our shows, I bring up three of the dwarf planets, Ceres, Pluto, and Eris. And I toy with the kids. I go, okay, which one's Pluto, after I talked about Pluto? And we have a little game up there. And I go, now which one's the biggest? Of course, Ceres is just, my God, it's so close. It must be it. And it's just this game we like to play in our planetarium.
Yeah. What's your current show, Alan?
Oh, we're going to be starting a show called Ringworld next week, actually, the first weekend of April. So Saturn's coming back in the sky, so we're going to be talking about Saturn and the Cassini mission.
Great. We'll have to come up and see you again.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan, so much for your call. It seems to me, and maybe it's just the bent of our shows, but tell me if this is true or not. It seems to me as though we've had a lot of news, and there seems to be a lot of interest now in the most distant galaxies, the possibility of life, you know, in galaxies way, 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 way out there. Is that true? And B, do you think there's too much focus on that and there's still a lot that we need to learn about our own planets?
I think that actually there's incredible interest in the entire universe, from the most distant galaxies to relatively nearby stars that might have planets around them, to what's going on in our own solar system. You know, there is no shortage of research into the very local planetary system. We have, as you just heard, there's the Cassini spacecraft is going around Saturn, taking just tremendous pictures and learning things like that there are giant methane lakes at the poles of Titan, the big moon on Saturn. There are rovers still roving on Mars all these years later. There's the first orbiter of Mercury is about to go into orbit today. I think it's today.
Really?
You know, so there's no shortage of exploration of the solar system, and yet at the same time, we have these new, incredible, powerful tools that can see to the very edge of the galaxy, or can see these tiny little blips of light around stars that are planets themselves, new planetary systems. So I wouldn't say that there needs to be more of any of those. I think that all of it is tremendously exciting, and I'm glad to be a little part of all of that.
Those rovers on Mars have really lasted so much longer than everybody thought, haven't they?
Yeah, they were supposed to be 90 days.
Goodness!
What are they now? They're 5 years, 6 years? They've gone so long, I've actually lost track of how many years they've been going at this point. But they were a 90-day mission, and they seem to be unstoppable.
Alan, thanks for the call. Scott in La Crosse is next. Hi, Scott.
Happy St. Patty's Day.
Hey, thanks, Scott, to you as well.
Now, I got a question for your guests there. First of all, actually, I got a suggestion. Everybody likes Pluto, and wasn't it, likes the name and all that, and wasn't it, Neil deGrasse Tyson has said that, you know, everybody learns Pluto, and, you know, Pluto, the Disney character. And,
right.
So, right, yeah, so it's our solar system. We're the only ones doing the naming, so here's my suggestion. Let's drop Uranus, which, you know, nobody's really comfortable with anyway, and let's name that Pluto. Everything's fine. Nobody misses another gas giant.
This is the best idea I've ever heard. I'm gonna go suggest this the next International Astronomical Society meeting.
The real question I called in to ask you about, though, is we have now 8 planets, yes, 4 inner rocky planets, which are all inner, and 4 gas giants, which are all outer. And my question, 2 questions really, is why do you think that is? Because really, when you get out further, wasn't Pluto like more of a rocky rocky mass itself. So why would there be, I mean, why is it just luck of the draw that we got four inner Rockies, four gas giants, and then out in the Oort cloud or whatever, we've got the little rocky substance again? And the second question is, if these really are just giant balls of gas out there, those four big ones, isn't it theoretically possible that you could actually fly through, something could fly through them?
Okay, let me answer the first one, then if I forget to answer the second one, remind me, because I like that one too. But the first one, I love that question. The reason I love that question, why is it that the solar system has four rocky planets on the inside, four giant planets on the outside, four gaseous giant planets on the outside, and then a band of these other things beyond? The reason I love that question is because that's the kind of question you ask when you actually see the solar system as it really is. If there had just been nine planets that are all more or less the same thing, which is the impression that a lot of people have, you don't even begin to ask that question. But this is the sort of question that astronomers are trying hard to understand, to try to understand how the entire solar system formed. And I think we have the basic outlines of the story. I think it actually makes a lot of sense that we have those four small rocky things and those four giant gaseous things the way we do. The reason that the inside has only rocky things instead of gassy things is that when the whole solar system initially formed, it formed out of this swirling cloud of gas and dust. And the cloud starts to spin, it turns into sort of a big pancake shaped things, and then planets start to coagulate out of this dust and gas. When the planets coagulate close to the sun, the dust starts to get together, but the sun boils the gases away. So we here at the Earth could have had been a more of a gas giant kind of thing with all that extra hydrogen and helium that Jupiter has, but the sun boiled it away. So we're just left with this rocky core. When you get further outside, when you get out to where Jupiter is and beyond, it's cold enough and there's enough material still left out there that you can hang on to all of that gas and you form these truly gigantic planets. Outside of Neptune, the things where Pluto is in the Kuiper Belt, Pluto and Eris and all those many, many thousands of objects out there are made out of rock and ice. And they're too small to have held on to the gas, but they're so cold that they get a lot of ice that we wouldn't have gotten in the inner part of the solar system. So you can put this whole story together once you start to understand how the solar system is really, really put about. And the details we're still working out and trying to look at other planetary systems around other stars, which are different, in some ways different, in some ways the same, is a great way to really try to test those theories. But that's, I think, the overall design. Now, and to quick answer the last one, could you just fly through the middle of these things? All of the giant planets, we think, have actual solid cores deep, deep, deep on the inside. But even if you wanted to try to visit that solid core, as you flew through Jupiter, for example, you would start to fly down through the middle of it. The pressures would be so strong that anything that we possibly have would be crushed before you could fly through the middle of it. The interior of Jupiter is liquid hydrogen. It's liquid because it's pressed down so much that it turns into this liquid. So it's not something that it would be very pleasant to try to actually fly through, I think.
Scott, you have the mind of an astronomer.
Whoa, I'm honored to hear this from this person particularly. Thank you so much. Great answers. I appreciate a lot. A wonderful show. And but just final note, every day I think I've heard we all ought to say a little quiet prayer of thanks to those gas giants for allowing us to be here by sopping up all those comets and stuff that would otherwise be pulverizing us. So
yeah,
Jupiter,
they've taken a lot of hits for us. They've done a good job.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Scott, as always, for your wonderful calls. Let's go to Bob in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning, Bob.
And the top of the Irish to you.
Thank you. You too.
I've got a Kennedy in my background with all my German genes. My grandmother was a Kennedy, so I can wear the green and be street legal.
Good for you.
Yeah. Hey, a couple of things. Speaking of Jupiter, Jupiter is setting after a long run in our evening sky. And last night, or the night before last, I'm a little confused on this, but it was sitting right on the western horizon, and I'm pretty sure that Mercury was just above it, a little bit to the right. And tonight probably isn't going to be a good night to look at it, but anybody who would like to see one of the largest objects and one of the smallest true planets in the solar system literally riding side by side, just go somewhere where you have a nice long flat view of the western horizon, and right after sunset, the two of them will be side by side, and it won't last long because Mercury comes and goes very quickly. And now my other question is, your guest was talking about Jupiter and all of the hydrogen. And it's my understanding that Jupiter has been called a failed star. Am I correct in that?
People sometimes say that sort of colloquially. I mean, it's not nearly massive enough to have been a star, but it has many of the characteristics. It has sort of the composition that you would have with a star. If you could take Jupiter and crank it up by maybe a factor of 60. You would start to be a real star, but it's pretty far from being a star these days.
Okay, so there's no chance of it spontaneously starting up somewhere in the next say a millennia or two.
No, and in fact, it goes the opposite way. Sometimes, if it were only about 15 times more massive, then it could have been a little bit like a star early on in its life when it was a little bit warmer. Right now it's cooling down so much that the chances of it, the ability of it to start to have nuclear fusion, that's what I'm meaning by saying it's a star. A star is something that's actually creating its own heat from nuclear fusion. But it's now cooled down so much over the past 4.5 billion years that there's no chance at all.
Okay. Well, I, for one, forgive you for killing off Pluto, but... I think it makes a remarkable story, and quite frankly, I can't wait to read your book.
Oh, well, thank you.
Wonderful. Have fun today, Bob.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, goodbye. Thanks for the call. When he talked about finding this long, flat view of the western sky, I want you to go way, way back, and you write about this in the book, about what it must have been like. I often think of this, to not have all these lights in the sky so that people were really seeing the sky. How was that different? How was that meaningful?
I think that we've lost something really special by having all these lights and not having this intimate connection with the night sky. I mean, I really appreciated the talking about Jupiter and about Mercury out there, because I think most people, everybody knows what the planets are, but I think most people have never realized that you can actually see them in the sky. These are not just things that are, you know, we get pictures back from NASA spacecraft or that we can see in a telescope. They're out there, and Jupiter is the king of them. Jupiter, probably every single person listening right now has seen Jupiter over the past couple of months, whether they know it or not. It's been that really big, bright thing near the western horizon at sunset. You can't miss it if you've seen anything in the sky. I think in the past, when there were no lights around, people would have seen these things and had a better connection with planets. The special thing about planets is that they move. The stars are in the same patterns year after year after year, and the planets move across that background of stars, and you can see it. You can watch them move over the course of a couple of nights if you're paying attention, but you don't pay attention in the bright skies. So I don't think most people have noticed it. You really get to see them on nights like the last couple nights and now, when Mercury and Jupiter are close together and they're in very different places night after night. You know that one of them has to be moving like that. It's a pretty fabulous thing. But I'm definitely sad about our loss of that deep connection that we have to the sky. I'm sad about the fact that people don't know that these planets are out there. They don't know that, you know, if you have your binoculars, you can take your binoculars out, just a regular set of binoculars. You can look at Jupiter tonight. You can go find it tonight and look with binoculars, and you can see those four moons of Jupiter that Galileo discovered.
Going around. Ooh, that's chilling.
With your binoculars. It's like everybody lives at the rim of the Grand Canyon and forgets to go look out the back and notice that there's a Grand Canyon behind them. It's just one of the most spectacular sights in the sky. So everybody go get your binoculars and go look at it one of these days.
Oh, Mike, get away. Well, we do other things, right? We're in front of the television set, or we're not talking to each other necessarily. We're not looking at the sky. We've kind of blocked it. It would be impossible for me to see this from where I live in the city and all the lights around.
No, that's it.
Can I see it?
Really? This is the best part. Jupiter is the brightest thing in the sky. So you have seen it. I mean, I live overlooking Los Angeles. There can't be too many brighter spots to live in the world. And I can see Jupiter every single night. I get out the binoculars. I show my daughter the moons around it. These things really are still there. We just forget to look up.
All right. So what time and where do I look tonight?
Sunset west.
Sunset west.
Yeah, so right at sunset, look to the west towards the horizon, and there will be a bright thing there, and it's that is Jupiter. And if you have some binoculars, grab some binoculars.
Okay.
Lean up against a wall to get really steady, and see if you can't see those four tiny little moons going in a line around it.
Okay, I'll do it. We're going to continue to take phone calls. Our guest is the author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Mike Brown is our guest. He is a professor of planetary astronomy at the California Institute of Technology, and he discovered a planet as well. To your phone calls, more of them momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming, Mike Brown, is our guest. And let's go next to Gail in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hello,
sure.
Mr. Brown.
Hi.
I follow astrology, and not as obsessively as some in the field, but I find it interesting and kind of comical that the timing of the demotion of Pluto from being a planet happened at the very end of its transit through the third fire sign in astrology, which would kind of be like taking the fire out of it. And then it moved into Capricorn, which is the third of the Earth planets. So it kind of got grounded in a way. But it's still in the field of astrology. It won't really affect astrology of how they communicate with the energies of the planet, but there's like that shift that's happened in between, and I found it really interesting that happened when it did, because it kind of gave us an indication of how we perceive everything in astronomy, and then how a different way of looking at the planet movements and what it may indicate to us in astrology is completely different, but some things will always be the same. Pluto will always be where it is, doing what it does, and we'll have everybody having their own impression of what it's going to be, which I think that is going to be the new meaning of what it is for us to be connecting with Pluto. And I just thought it was funny, too. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Mike.
Thank you. So, you know, it's interesting. As astronomers and astrologers tend to not get along very well and haven't for centuries. But astrology and astronomy started from the same place. They were just sort of, I like to think of them as a scientific and a literary way of thinking about the sky. And so I was interested that as all these new discoveries came along, some of the people who were most interested in learning about the discoveries were the astrologers. The astronomers were often busy, you know, needing to understand this part of their research and that, but the celebrated the discoveries in ways that even astronomers didn't. And I find that really interesting. It's not, you know, as an astronomer, I certainly don't think that there is any predictive quality to astrology or that there is actually an effect. But I think that that is a culturally interesting thing. How can we not sort of feel like we're part of this universe around us and that it somehow affects us? Even if it scientifically doesn't, in a emotional, cultural sense, it feels like it does. And I think this is just a way for people to have these connections with the universe and the sky. So I am, even though, I mean, I will again say I don't, as a scientist, I don't think there's any actual power in the predictions of astrology. I still think there's power in the emotions and the cultural impact. And I'm actually much more interested and comfortable with it than I think most astronomers tend to be. Most astronomers would kind of cringe even to hear me say this right now, I suspect.
Thank you, Gail, very much for your call. Here's an email that's come in, Mike, from Jeff, Senior Instrumentation Specialist at the University of Wisconsin's Botany Department. On March 19, he wants to inform us, a full moon of rare size and beauty will rise in the east at sunset. It's a super perigee moon, the biggest in almost 20 years. Am I pronouncing that right, perigee moon?
Perigee, yeah.
Perigee moon. What is that?
Perigee, it means that it's the closest that the moon ever comes to the Earth. So the moon is in a slightly eccentric orbit, and sometimes it's a little bit closer, sometimes it's a little bit further. It happens to be at its closest at the same time as the full moon, so it's the biggest looking full moon. Unless you have been paying really, 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 really close attention, you won't notice any difference whatsoever. But it's still, I think full moons are one of the most spectacular things that you can see in the sky. They light up the ground. This one will light up the ground even more. They are rising just as the sun is setting. There's this great cosmic balance going on. So I would encourage everyone to go out and find it. It is the biggest one. If you want to see this biggest one of the past 20 years, go out and find it. It's a great one to see.
Well, you should go find it just to say, if you're alive 20 years from now, 20 years ago, I saw the largest perigee moon. It's a big event. You can tell your family about it. And we don't do things enough like that. Our family does that occasionally when we hear about these events, but somehow it should be on the front page of newspapers. Hey, by the way, tonight is the night that you got to go see this. It's the biggest full moon in 20 years, and this is it's significant. We need to be informed about this more, don't you think?
I think you're right, and there are places where you can find these things. You can find astronomy websites, and you'll find it on page 16 of the newspaper, if you look carefully. But there's a lot of interesting stuff going on that we never get to hear about it. But it just I think it's because these things happen night after night, time after time. You sort of remember that there's a meteor shower in August and you're supposed to look up, or maybe one in December, and they happen enough that they become sort of blasé and not real. But that means no one goes and looks at these things. They're still I really do think that everyone should get to know your sky better. It's like getting to know your neighborhood, but it's the neighborhood that you get to carry around with you no matter where you go.
Right. We should do more of that here when things like this happen. Where should we go? Where would we find just a listing of what's happening? We could pass along the word, certainly, but I don't know where to go.
We talked earlier about Astronomy Magazine, so I'll just say that they have a website that tells what's going on in the sky. The other big astronomy magazine around is Sky and Telescope. They have a website that tells what's going on in the sky. And many, many, many others these days. Probably all your local planetarium has a website that tells what's going on in the sky. I suspect almost anywhere you could find this sort of information.
Yeah, we got a buddy at the Adler who could maybe be our guest every now and then.
Yeah, and I'm sure the Adler has a website that says all this too. There are so many good astronomical resources out there, just waiting to be found.
Right. So what are you working on now, Mike?
Well, there are a couple of things that I'm really excited about, but I think the most exciting one right now is the one little tidbit of science that was totally unexpected that we found while staring across the whole skies was that we found this one object really, 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 really far away. It's currently about three times further away than Pluto. But it's on a very, very eccentric orbit. It goes to 300 times further away than Pluto. It takes 12,000 years to go around the sun. It's the most distant orbit of anything that we can see going around the sun these days. And it shouldn't be there. And whenever you find something that shouldn't be there, it's this immense clue that there's something going on and you don't know what it is. we have a lot of ideas. I personally think that it's basically a fossil left over from the birth of the sun, that this thing formed back 4.5 billion years ago and has been just sitting there waiting for 4.5 billion years to be found. And then if we can find more of these fossils, we'll be able to put together the record of how the sun actually got here, how it was born. And this is, to me, a tremendously exciting prospect. There aren't many clues that we have for what was around here before the planets actually formed, and this could be one of them. So I'm desperately seeking more of these. They're hard to find. They're very distant. The one that we found was probably the brightest one out there, so it was the easiest to find. The rest of them have been quite elusive, but I think they're out there, and I think we'll learn a tremendous amount as we find those more distant things.
Wouldn't it be fun to write the book, How the Sun Was Born, down the road?
Yeah.
Mike, thank you so much for being with us. Really enjoyed the hour in the book. Thanks.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Mike Brown, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. So that's it for today. Have a wonderful St. Patrick's Day. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for a lot of extra work to put together, particularly the first hour of the program. And thank you for your calls and all of your emails, too, everybody. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.